Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast was recorded on Tuesday, June 28, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum Conference Call. We're very pleased today to offer a special program commemorating the upcoming 25th anniversary of Justice Clarence Thomas's nomination to the Supreme Court, which was July 1, 1991. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts Boyden Gray, Greg Katsas, John Yu, and Carrie Severino. More complete bios were provided you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for their presentations in the sequence announced, followed by your questions at around the 30-minute mark of the program. And with that, Mr. Gray, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, and it's a privilege to comment on the 25th anniversary. I cannot believe it's been 25 years since you went on the court. I thought I would just speak for just a couple of minutes about some of the background, which may not be known to the general public. President Bush had his eye on Justice Thomas from the Reagan years, from the second term when he was in the Department of Education, and thought he was a great talent. And so when the opportunity arose to put him on the Court of Appeals, there was never any hesitation about that. And that nomination was well received, and I think passed the Senate rather easily. When the opening arose with Brennan's resignation, the president wanted to go right away with then Judge Thomas, on the grounds that the next opening would likely be Marshall, who was not in great health, and he didn't want to have a black replacing a black. It looked too much like quotas, which he knew Thomas detested, and that was one of the appeals that Thomas held for all of us, is that he was against intentional discrimination, throw the book at whoever engaged in it, but not for group rights. And so both Thornburg and I, Attorney General Thornburg and I, thought that he was not ready. He needed more time on the Court of Appeals, Judge Thomas, before he went on the Supreme Court. One can quarrel about whether we made the right choice on Souter, of course, but I don't think there's any doubt that we were right to wait and let him have some more seasoning on the Court of Appeals, in large part because he made a very good impression on everybody there, and we would never have made the nomination had we not sort of informally checked with his colleagues on the Court of Appeals and found him universally admired on both sides of the philosophical aisle, if you will. And so that was a key factor, plus having Senator Danforth, who had given him his first job. He has exceeded all of our expectations about the magnitude of his talent. It's just one of the really missed opportunities that the mainstream media has totally ignored the contributions he has made and seemed to focus solely on the fact that he doesn't speak frequently and interrupt frequently at oral argument, as if that had a lot to do with his scholarship and with his contribution. I think that his opinions are as lucid and as erudite as any one can think about in recent years, and that has always been a great source of pride for me and for President Bush, who views this as one of his as one of the best things he ever did. I think we'll see whether for the next 25 years Justice Thomas's mark will be where he seems to be planting his feet, which is a very broad-based questioning of the administrative state, both on the questions of the delegation, non-delegation doctrine, and its first cousin, the doctrine of deference of Chevron. And I think he's already established a base for challenging what's happened. Others coming after me will talk more about this, I hope. I just wanted to introduce it to say that I think that this is going to be, I hope this will be his finest contribution, but there's no question that he has changed the debate. This, I think, we'll get some comment in a couple of minutes, but he really did change the debate about the use of racial preferences, using his own example and his own career. And the contribution he's made to getting rid of racial preferences, at least in hiring, has been, I think, one of the great contributions he's already made to the court. So I'll stop there and turn it over to the real experts. Greg Katsas, you're going to follow me and talk about his first term on the court.
Right. Thanks, Boyden. I clerked for Justice Thomas his first year, so I thought I would share a couple of stories, opinions from that year, which really illustrate the kind of justice and kind of person he is, and which foreshadow the kind of justice he would become. First point is Justice Thomas as someone who has the courage of his convictions and has this incredible sense of duty to the country and to himself and to his oath to get cases right, even if that means bucking his colleagues and bucking conventional opinion. That was illustrated in spectacular fashion in the justice's very first sitting. I can give you the backstory because all of this material, much of which would have otherwise been private, was made public with the release of Justice Blackmun's papers, so I'm not divulging any court confidences. Justice Thomas was confirmed 2 weeks before the November sitting. He didn't have the luxury of a summer on the front end to get ready. He had a large stack of hold petitions. All the petitions that had 3 out of 8 votes to grant were being held. He had to get the chamber set up. He was only 43 years old at the time. He had just been through a brutal confirmation in which he was savagely attacked because people thought he would be conservative. It would have been the easiest thing in the world and very understandable thing for him under those circumstances to just go along a little bit, to get along. He didn't. In the very first sitting, in those days there were probably about 15 cases, few more than nowadays, but not a whole lot. In conference, he was the sole dissenter 3 times, 8-1 votes, with Justice Thomas the one. He was dead right in every one of those votes. We were sort of astonished. The conventional wisdom that was with Thomas replacing Marshall, this would now finally be a conservative court, and he and we get thrown in under those circumstances, and what happens in the first sitting, these cases come up, and the court holds that one case they say that when a capital defendant puts on evidence, mitigating evidence of his supposedly good character, the state is constitutionally prohibited from putting on countervailing evidence that, oh, by the way, notwithstanding that this guy might have baked cookies or whatever, you should also know that he's a member of a white supremacist prison gang. That decision came out 8-1 with the justice, the sole dissenter. Second case in which he resisted the constitutionalization of every tort committed by a prison guard against a prisoner, and the majority wanted to say that when a guard roughs up a prisoner, that's not only a state law tort, it's an Eighth Amendment violation. That was 8-1 at conference. That case came out as the justice dissenting in a 7-2 case, with Justice Scalia flipping his original vote and joining Justice Thomas. And the third case, the majority said that when someone is acquitted on an insanity ground, the state can hold him for a while, can civilly commit him for a while, but the civil commitment cannot extend so long as the person remains dangerous. And that case came out, was 8-1 at conference, with CT, the sole voice of reason. That one came out 5-4, with Scalia, Rehnquist, and Kennedy all coming around to the Thomas position. And ironically, with a lot of people in the media carping about how they thought Thomas seemed to be mindlessly following Scalia. In fact, the reality right from the get-go with these cases was, to a large extent, Scalia following Thomas. For better or worse, there have been no shortage of 8-1s since then. Second point is the sort of style and sweep of his opinions. I'll just say a couple of things about a case called Wright versus West, which came up to the when it came up to the court, it was arguably the narrowest and least significant and absurdly fact-bound case that's ever been granted. Literally, the question presented was whether there was sufficient evidence to sustain a state court criminal conviction. A panel on the Fourth Circuit on habeas had said there was insufficient evidence to sustain a burglary conviction where, like, all of the burgled stuff was found in the defendant's house, and the court said something like, well, it wasn't proven how he got the stuff. So really crazy. It's effectively a summary reversal. Justice Thomas was assigned the opinion. Could have been the easiest, narrowest decision in the world, 9-0. But he didn't stop there. He asked himself the much broader question of, well, why are federal habeas courts relitigating all of these questions de novo without any deference to the state court judge who sat through the trial, and the state courts who under our Constitution are entrusted with handling criminal process? And he wrote a very long, very scholarly opinion in Wright, basically making the case for deference across the board to state court legal determinations in habeas. And that was too much for the majority. What would have been a 9-0 opinion came out 3-3-1-1-1, which seemed like not such a great thing at the time, but the justice has his view on writing for the ages, and this one actually turned out pretty well because a couple of years later, Congress adopted the position that the justice has staked out in AEDPA, and the now very familiar, settled principle of deference to state court legal determinations on federal habeas review is codified in federal law and comes directly out of Justice Thomas's efforts in that opinion. And the last one I'll mention tees up the question of the justice's views on matters of race. Obviously, something that's been important in his life and where his life story and experiences inform his views. We had a case called United States versus Fortas, which was about the remedial standards for desegregating public universities. And the doctrine was basically, once you have a finding of intentional discrimination, which unquestionably there was in this case, this is the Mississippi state system, so no question of past discrimination. And the court had said in these remedy cases, once you have that finding, the courts have virtually unfettered authority to remake institutions however they want and do things they otherwise couldn't do, like assure racial balancing on the theory that you're just remedying vestiges of discrimination rather than imposing balancing for its own sake. And the majority opinion had a lot of this rhetoric about remedies being broad and the need to eliminate vestiges. And he joined that opinion, but he also struggled with it because he understood that the law of unintended consequences often operates in this area. And he was worried about historically black colleges, and he foresaw that if you really apply this rule that, the court should remake institutions to have racial balancing, well, that would be the end of black colleges. And he wrote a short but very poignant opinion in which he said, we should keep this in mind and we shouldn't, in the name of eliminating effects of segregation, destroy the very institutions that sustain blacks during the period of de jure segregation. Those are some of the highlights from the first year. So with that, let me turn the floor over to John Yu.
Well, thanks very much to the Federal Society and to my co-panelists for this opportunity. I think this is a great chance to sit and reflect on the meaning of Justice Thomas's first 25 years. I feel like we're at halftime in a football game because I think we're only halfway through the justice's career, and we can look back and see how his performance has been in the first half, but we care a lot about the second half and whether his team's going to win. Before I start about just a few thoughts about that, I'd just like to tell two stories about the justice, which I think actually reveal a lot about how he thinks about the law. So, one thing is that he is a big fan of the Fountainhead movie, which is from, I think, the 1950s and shot in black and white. I think as Gary Cooper is the guy who plays the architect in the Ayn Rand book, Howard Roark, and it has a variety of other people you'd recognize but don't remember anymore. I really think it's a terrible, terrible movie, and I really didn't like the book much either. But the justice loves the movie, and he makes sure that when you clerk for him, you watch it with him. And so I remember watching the movie with him when we clerked and sitting there and just complaining about what a bad movie it was. But I think the movie itself, you can tell a lot about the justice about why he likes it, because the story of the movie is about an architect who remains committed to his principles, about what he thinks of as beauty and architecture, and doing it his way, despite the criticisms of media or popular opinion. He's determined to design the building the way he thinks is best. And I think that's a lot about the justice, that he is one of these people who's so committed to his principles that he is willing to follow them despite, I think this builds on what Greg just said, he's willing to follow them despite what might be precedent of the court, the views of his colleagues, academic opinion, which I think is the last thing he should consider, and public opinion, the voice of the media or even polls. And if, you know, for those who follow the court or don't, you know, that principle that he follows, I think more closely than anything, is fidelity to the constitutional text as it was understood by those who drafted and ratified it. I think it's fair to say that the members of the current court, he is the justice most committed to following the original understanding of the Constitution. And, you know, someone who's studied, I think he may be the justice in the history of the entire Supreme Court most committed to following the original understanding of the Constitution, even if, or especially if it's at odds with what his policy preferences are. One example is his commitment starting in United States versus Lopez and going through Gonzalez versus Reich into current cases that the power of the federal government has to be limited to those written in the Article 1, Section 8 enumeration of legislative power. He thinks that the great font of power that's been used by the welfare state to grow, the Commerce Clause, only covers commercial transactions that cross state borders, a view that the court used to hold until the New Deal. This would cause him to find, as he's said in these opinions, that most of the drug laws, federal drug laws, are unconstitutional, even though he would say, I'm sure that this is not what he prefers as a matter of policy if he were a voter, but he feels that he has to follow the original understanding. I think this is also true of his views about the balance of power between the jury and judges when he voted in a case called Apprendi, that the Supreme Court over the years had allowed judges to take too much power away from juries in sentencing, and he voted to throw out probably, I would imagine, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of sentences around the country, nationwide, because he felt we had to return to the original understanding of the role of the jury. The second little story I would tell is that the justice is someone, I think, who, of all the justices, is sort of the most normal, regular American on the court. You could tell by his summer vacations. You know, he doesn't jet off to Salzburg, Austria, over the summers to hobnob with the European elites, although I don't know why anyone would want to. I mean, food there is terrible. He doesn't jet off to Aspen, Colorado to hobnob with, you know, leading, wealthy Americans and thought leaders and whoever else goes to Aspen in the summers. But what he does is he gets in a recreational vehicle, gigantic bus, basically, and drives around the country, just stopping at various places to see, often spending the night, Walmart parking lots with other RV people. You know, I confess, again, I'm not a fan of RV culture. I don't quite get it, but I think it tells a lot about the justice. He loves nothing more, I think, than to mix with other regular Americans. He doesn't see himself in any way as special. He doesn't want to be treated any differently than anyone else, and he just likes to interact with people just as if he were the country lawyer or, you know, like a local state judge. I think that tells a lot about him, too, especially if you read his opinions. They're written, and he used to tell us this when we were working for him, is that he wants them to be something that any normal citizen can understand, or he wants you to be able to explain this case to your mother, and he wants the things that he writes to be read that way. So I guess the second major point I would just make about what he's done the last 25 years, obviously, is his views on race. I think he, of all the justices on the court now, is the most committed to a colorblind constitution. It started in the case that Greg mentioned, and then it continued with Adoram versus Pena, which was decided my term, where I think most interestingly he cited the Declaration of Independence, not just the Constitution, as a true source of the idea that all men are created equal and the government cannot classify citizens based on race for good or ill. And then, of course, it continued in cases like Grutter versus Bollinger. I think something I just like to read that he wrote there, I think is quite incredible, is that he doesn't want the government to hurt or help Blasey just wants them to not classify people by race. And so he wrote, quoting Frederick Douglass, he said, "If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall also. All I ask is give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone." It's a powerful language that only he really could speak on the court. And then I think, you know, in addition to his views on race and his commitment to the original understanding here, I just close, I think the third thing that he will stand for, and this really more turns now to the second half of his career, as Boyden mentioned, is his growing skepticism of the administrative state. He's written in the last 2 years remarkable opinions questioning the very foundations of the New Deal state, particularly the ability of Congress to delegate to the agencies the power to make regulations that have the binding force of law. And I think if you're going to look back at when we have this call, I hope we're all here after his 50th year, we'll look and see that he has been the leader in trying to reevaluate and restrict all of the ways that the administrative state has grown. So with that, I hope we do see everybody here again in 25 years, and turn it over to Carrie.
Thanks, John. So there's been so much great ground covered. I'll just see if I can fill a couple of little holes of thoughts I had on Justice Thomas's legacy. And first, following up on some of the things that both Greg and John have said about how his approach to race shaped his view of government, I'll just add another area. And I think that is that perhaps having grown up in a system of basically state-sanctioned segregation, growing up under Jim Crow, really probably was one of the foundational things that helped Justice Thomas have his real skepticism of government. I think part of the reason he is so committed to the constitutional system is because he realizes that it's put there, the checks and balances, the limits on government, the fact that they aren't given all power, you know, under heaven and earth, but they're given certain limited enumerated powers, is because our founders recognized the risks of putting too much power in any one set of hands, and he has seen that firsthand. And so I think that that experience definitely helped shape his skepticism and concern about government. Another theme that I think, going back, following up on the kind of hitting the reset button, willing to really question the foundations of things, is actually one that came out in the case yesterday that maybe will be the start of the next big idea that Justice Thomas will explore, and that was in his dissent in the Hellerstedt case that just was announced yesterday. This is a Texas abortion case, and it was purporting to apply the undue burden standard, which is a standard that the intermediate scrutiny shouldn't be, not as high as strict scrutiny, which would apply for most or many rights in the Constitution. I guess we have almost different standards for everyone sometimes, it seems now. But that was one of the things that Justice Thomas criticized. First, he called the court out on treating, in this case, the undue burden standard as even higher than they treated last week the strict scrutiny standard in the Fisher versus Texas racial preference case. They kind of treated the strict scrutiny standard like it was nothing, and then they've elevated the undue burden standard to be almost unsurmountable by a state regulation. And he actually, in his dissent, questioned the very notion of having all of these standards of review. So this is something that we all almost take for granted. We see in law school from very early on all the tripartite strict or intermediate scrutiny and then the rational basis scrutiny. And he basically called it out. He said, this isn't based on the Constitution. This is something that and we often say to us, but they're just making it up. And it's refreshing to see it come out in an opinion, but it's true. That some of these things, the judges have just made these standards up. And, you know, it would be one thing if it was a attempted way to get at what the original constitutional meaning is supposed to be. But it's gotten to the point now that people now mouth deference. They don't even mouth deference to the Constitution. They'll mouth deference to a standard that was judge-derived and kind of invented on top of that to the Constitution. And they go on and do what seems to them to be politically expedient often. And so he seems to be now advocating almost for, let's get rid of all of these silly standards on top of things and just try to go right back to basics. And then the last thing I'll comment on is just aspects of his judicial philosophy that I think make him one of the most principled judges out there. Commentators are often talking about, you know, we like to say that we should be judging based on our core philosophy and principles and not politics, but they'll all say, oh, both sides are doing politics. But I was really struck in a discussion I had with Professor Michael Dorff recently, a liberal scholar, the Kennedy clerk, and he said, you know, more or less, I guess your side, at least, you know, everyone claims they're both doing it, but maybe the difference is that your side, i.e. the conservative side, is the only one that even views that as a goal anymore. And so, and I think that's true, that there's something about the judicial philosophy that even when someone doesn't live up to it, at least having the right goals and having the right philosophy that doesn't invite politics to come into it can constrain things. So if your philosophy looks to an evolving standard, it's much more tempting, you know, even unbeknownst to you, to import your own views. Justice Thomas's philosophy, I think, is uniquely difficult to import those things into, and that is definitely a feature, not a bug of this. Yeah, and with this conversation with Dorff, he acknowledged that the only justice he couldn't say that with a straight face about is Justice Thomas. He does not import his political views into his writing. Even people who disagree with him on the results of any of the cases have to agree that he's not doing this for politics. He's doing it because of the principle. John mentioned some of the lines of cases, the Commerce Clause and some of the jury rights. I think it's really interesting to see that he repeatedly is often in those cases voting against his what one would consider his conservative policy interests. And I think part of what makes him so consistent is another feature that he is unique on the court in, which is his more or less disdain for the concept of stare decisis. Now, that's not to say he's not going to follow precedent. I think first of all, he certainly will follow precedent that he thinks is right, but that doesn't mean much, right? He'll say, I didn't take an oath. I took an oath to the Constitution. I didn't take an oath to how some guy read it wrong. And so certainly he'll follow precedent that he thinks is right, but I think for him, it would be more of if it's kind of an equipoise, both of these might be reasonable ways to look at it. Let's go with what precedent said. But in so many cases, the precedent is so profoundly wrong that he's willing to just start over from scratch. I think that frees him to not import his views, because when you think about the test people often use for when am I willing to overturn a case and when should I just follow it, those sorts of tests of how, you know, they invite a lot of judgment calls of how much has this been relied on and how important of an issue is it? And all of those areas, anytime you get a multi-part test, of course, all of the balancing things invite a judge to use the test to just get at their gut feeling about the case. And so it makes it very easy for people to just say they're going to overrule cases they disagree with on important issues, and they'll be happy to follow precedent, even precedent that's constitutionally suspect, in cases that it gets them to their right policy goal. Well, Justice Thomas, regardless of the immediate outcomes in that case, if it means freeing or decreasing the sentence for someone he thinks is a horrific criminal, if it means overturning a law that he thinks probably would have been good policy, if it means upholding a law he thinks is horrible policy, he's still going to say, you know what, that's not the right constitutional basis. And so I think his clear view of his duty being to the Constitution first and not to stare decisis and not to any previous court precedent also helps him to be, for me, one of the most consistent justices on the court, one of the most principled, and calling all of his fellow justices to a similar level of principle. I think that certainly had an influence on Justice Scalia, who famously has called himself a faint-hearted originalist because he did believe in stare decisis to a certain extent. But I think Justice Thomas's influence was calling him to that, you know, more courageous option of let's just get this right. The justice would often show us a wire coat hanger, and you'd say, look at this coat hanger, and you bend it. Once you bent it, how are you going to get back how it was before? Can you bend it a little bit, you know, one layer down, and still point in the same direction, but it's a little off? You'll never get it perfectly back straight. If any time you're trying to deal with and work through bad precedent, you're going to always still have these weird dysfunction within the law, that's areas that it's going to be distorted. That's why he just realizes the only way to get it all right and stay true to your oath to the Constitution is to go back to basics, to start with the Constitution itself. So with that, I'll hand it back to Will, I guess, if we have any other comments to go.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for those remarks. We're going to go ahead and open up the queued audience questions here. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. But again, if you'd like to join our question queue, please enter star and then the pound key. While we wait for people to queue up here, I want to give everyone a quick chance to just respond to some of their colleagues' comments. We'll go to you first, Boyden Gray. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think that I love John Yoo's anecdotes. Justice Breyer once told me that when they do travel, sometimes in groups of two or three, maybe even four, to a conference or whatnot, the only one that is recognized by anybody in an airport is Justice Thomas, and that it's all very, very amusing for all of them, and Thomas handles it with such grace. It's a wonderful testament to his real life, easygoing personality that he can relate to anybody, and he's universally liked by everybody who runs into him, even if they can't remember exactly where they first saw his face or first heard his name. So that's the thing that always Thomas. The one thing which has been mentioned, which the listeners ought to know, is that no one, and I say literally no one, has as infectious a laugh as Justice Thomas, and it is a wonder to behold and a wonderful thing to hear.
Greg Katsas, do you have anything to add?
Just a couple more thoughts on the administrative state and the deference point. That's a remarkable area. The scope and breadth of the three or four Thomas opinions from last term attacking the administrative state, really root and branches. And it's an interesting area to trace the relationship between Scalia and Thomas, because this is an area where they started on opposite ends of the spectrum, with Scalia being probably more pro-deference than any other member of the court, right? He thought that the non-delegation doctrine was not judicially enforceable, just because he loves rules and hates standards and couldn't think of any rule-based way of doing it. And he thought that Chevron was the greatest thing since sliced bread, on the view that it's better to have the political branches deciding close legal questions than the courts. And boy, the force of the Thomas opinions really seemed to move Scalia over time. Scalia, by the end of his tenure, explicitly advocated abandoning, not quite Chevron, but the related doctrine that courts defer to agency interpretations of their own regulations. That's called Auer deference. It's named after a case called Auer, which Justice Scalia wrote. And even in the context of Chevron, by the end, Scalia was saying things like, well, it's probably inconsistent with the Administrative Procedure Act, but it may be consistent with how courts have done things. Or he would say things like, well, we have all these anomalies in the law, and it's kind of hard to figure out how to solve them, at least if Chevron is not to be abandoned. I think he had moved substantially in response to Justice Thomas's critique, and probably would have moved a lot more if he had had more time.
John Yoo, any thoughts here before we start taking the audience questions? We do have four people in line waiting for their questions.
No,
and I invite more to join with star and the pound key while we move along here.
Yeah, I'm happy to go right to the questions. I don't have anything further to add.
Okay, and Carrie, I'll give you a last shot too.
I think the only last shot would be an anecdote, because the only other aspect we haven't talked about is personality, great humility, and He certainly was, he knew everyone down to the janitor and the elevator operators in the court, knew what team they rooted for, knew if their mom was in the hospital and would ask him how she was doing. But one thing that I thought people don't recognize about the justice is because he doesn't speak on the court, they assume he is super quiet. And while he is an introvert, he definitely doesn't speak during oral arguments because he doesn't like interrupting people and he thinks it's more respectful to the attorneys to not try to jump all over their argument. He is such a talkative person behind the scenes. I was clerking a year that I had a toddler at home, and I was always trying to get out the door to get to dinner. And I think one of the only reasons I was able to do that on a regular basis was because I didn't happen to end up sitting in, we had a court was under construction, and we didn't end up having a chambers for the room for the clerks in the chamber. So Justice Thomas wasn't able to stop by as often as maybe he otherwise would have to chat. Because once you got in his thrall, you would be there for hours discussing everything from the upcoming cases to, you know, the sports teams that you were following to just life advice or great stories from when he'd been, people he'd served with in the court, years before. So I don't think people who think of him as a quiet justice certainly don't know the Justice Thomas we see behind the scenes.
All right, so we have four callers on the line here. We'll dig into these. Please, everyone, do identify yourself before you ask your question. And if at any point you'd like to join our question queue, I invite you to do so by hitting star and then the pound key. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Downs, and I write for Red Alert Politics, which is a millennial center-right based publication. So I was just wondering if anybody had any thoughts on whether his issues or his personalities or his opinions, how they might appeal to young people, especially because I remember, I believe it was Professor John Yu who referred to how, you know, this is, we could be hearing about him in 25 more years. So I was wondering if you had anything to say for the millennial generation at all about Clarence Thomas and his legacy.
I'll add one thing, that is, he's actually one of the more technically sophisticated people on the bench. When he did the report, and I think Greg could probably speak to this, I don't think anyone used email. I mean, they just didn't have any of this infrastructure there. And
we
it didn't exist. But now he was really the head of help of the justices trying to bring them into the 21st century there. Right. And is much more, I think his chamber is probably for a long time. Now that we have some newer, younger justices, they're probably using technology to its fullest too. But the fact that he would actually communicate with his clerks via email, and that you can use some of those technologies even internally in helping edit things or something, rather than the almost typewriter and carbon copy bound judges before him. So he's even like changing out his own memory on his computer. He actually knows what he's doing.
This is John Yu. I'm not sure what millennials themselves like or if they all agree on something, but one thing, you know, just having to spend so much time with them at class and in campus, and, one thing I get the sense of is that millennials really are kind of skeptical of government regulation in a lot of ways. They don't understand why the government, you know, the local city cab commission can tell you whether you can pick up people for $6 and drive them somewhere in your own car, or rent out a room in your apartment if you feel like it to other people. And I got to say, I would think of, you know, this is not a libertarian court on economic issues, but if there were of the ones who are there now, the one who I would suspect would be most sympathetic to claims of some kind of individual right to pursue the trade you want to pursue or to use your property the way you want to use it free of government interference is going to be Justice Thomas, I think.
Right.
I bet he doesn't himself. I don't know if he's ever taken Uber. I bet he hasn't. I can't imagine him using Airbnb. But I would think of all the nine there now, eight there now and the nine to come, I think he would be the first one to vote against the idea that the government can, you know, ban Uber as the city of Austin has, or tax, put taxes on Airbnb, or put all kinds of crazy licensing requirements on what occupations you're allowed to pursue. So I think in that that's the thing I get about millennials, is that's something a lot of them seem to agree on, whether they're conservative or liberal, is a sort of nonsensical irrational local regulations of how you make your living. And justice, I think, is a big, you know, if any of them, is more of a big believer in economic liberties as well as, you know, the other more usual civil and political rights.
Great. That was very helpful. Thank you.
This is Boyden Gray. I just want to supplement that by saying if my own 30-year-old daughter, now 31, just 31, is a millennial, and if she's representative, she like a lot of her contemporaries, they just don't like bigness, you know, and that's the flip side of what John Hughes was just talking about. She I think Thomas is very skeptical of bigness, whether it's whether it's private or whether it's public. I think he just is very distrustful of gigantic enterprises.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
All right, we have five callers now on the line waiting to ask their questions, so we'll keep moving right along.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg at the Center for Equal Opportunity, and thank you all very much. This has been a terrific presentation. I had one just brief comment on something that Carrie said. It's certainly true that while frequently liberals will criticize conservative justices for writing something that they say is inconsistent with, you know, with their principles, that kind of criticism is rarely found by conservatives criticizing liberal justices. But the reason for that is that there are no liberal principles that they can be inconsistent with. It's just sort of understood that, you know, on the left, you know, rulings are going to be made based on policy preferences, and so, you know, there can't be any accusation of inconsistency. The question I had was whether you all could comment on how the justice selects his law clerks and whether that provides any, you know, insight into his character and philosophy.
I don't know who wants to jump in. I haven't actually been part of the process as much. The justice had hired out several years when I was clerking. We didn't even get to do a lot of interviewing. But I think one thing that's interesting that you can just see from the list of clerks he has, he's not limiting himself to someone who is on Harvard or Yale Law Review, which I think a lot of the justices, it's like, if you didn't go to an Ivy League school, you need not apply. If you weren't on Law Review, you need not apply. And he's much more egalitarian. He will hire people from all over the country. He really believes there's more than, you know, just 30-some people out there who would be excellent at this job, and you don't have to confine yourself, and that you're going to get a much more interesting and talented group if you look more broadly at the country as a whole.
And
he's also
there's
some like the people who are not immediately coming from law school too, which also brings interesting diversity and experience to the chambers.
The only thing I would add, I think Carrie's got it pretty much right. I think the only thing I would add is, and it's also I think a reflection of his Justice Thomas's nature or character, is that he's a very loyal person both to his clerks and his friends. And I think part of that loyalty is that if there were one. You know, lawyers would call it outcome determinative factor, I think, for hiring clerks for him. It's who they clerked for in the lower court. And I think Justice Thomas has a number of very good friends in the judiciary whose views and opinions he, you know, takes very seriously. And so I think it kind of builds also on what Carrie says. He's much more willing to trust the evaluation or opinions of people that a candidate has already worked for, much more than whether they got all A's at Harvard like Greg Katsas did.
Any other comment on that? Greg Katsas, do you want to defend yourself?
I'll stand silent.
Okay.
Well, Greg's an exception to that rule because he clerked for the most trusted of lower court justices before he clerked for justice.
I'm living proof that it's better to be lucky than good, since I was with him at the D.C. Circuit. how I got my clerkship.
Well, we still have four callers on the line now, so we'll move to the next one.
Hello, this is David Fetter from Munder, Tolles & Olson. I guess I'm a millennial, so I just wanted to add a quick comment on that point. I think one thing that millennials might be attracted to is, just as Thomas sort of, he has his own viewpoint and he's very faithful to that viewpoint. You're not going to see him joining an opinion using the non-originalist methodology just because it's easier or for whatever reason. So that's something that really attracts me personally, just Thomas. My question is, I'd be curious to know what you all think is the justice's most significant doctrinal contribution, or perhaps what his most significant case where he's written the majority opinion has been.
Anyone want to jump in here?
Well, I'd just make a quick comment that it's not all that well known now, but I always think, and it's been mentioned in this call, that the Adorand decision really cast a long shadow forward and looked back into his own past, and I really think that's an important case to remember, where he attacks group rights, and where he opens up a debate, which ultimately I think he wins, about at least hiring preferences for groups.
Mm-hmm.
Doctrinal contribution is a little hard to say, just because there are so many. There's hardly an area of law that hasn't been touched by one of his very broad, bold, back to first principles opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Commerce clause, non-delegation, necessary and proper clause, war powers, administrative state, the establishment clause, all of the race-related issues, colorblind, everything from colorblindness to cross-burning, and then even sub-constitutional issues like retroactivity and implied preemption. Majority opinion, the depressing answer is that this is not an originalist court, so most of these are separate writings.
Sure.
You know, I think his main contribution has been to expand the range of what seems possible, and to have his colleagues and law students and professors and the world at large seeing the case for a narrower view of the Commerce Clause and so on. Who knows whether it'll take hold? You know, it's not looking terribly optimistic right now, but 25 years is a long time, so we'll see.
I just want to throw in one comment on what Greg and Boyden said, is that most of the Justice Thomas's well-known opinions and his contributions have not been majority opinions, and in fact, they couldn't be majority opinions. I think as Greg mentioned from his first term, he someone who'd rather follow principle, fidelity to the original Constitution, than getting five votes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are other justices who'd rather have the five votes and
sure.
put aside, you know, are not principled about methodology. And so almost all the great opinions of Justice Thomas, I think, are all concurrences and dissents. I think I'm sure he doesn't think of himself this way, but if there was someone I would compare him to in that respect, it would be Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, the great dissenter,
right.
was his nickname.
Right.
And he you know, the things that we remember about Holmes as his great contributions were not majority opinions. They're concurrent, separate concurrences, and most often they are individual dissents. And I think if at the end of the 50 years, if the justice looked back on his career, he'd rather be the Oliver Wendell Holmes of his time, the great dissenter, rather than someone who was successful in writing a bunch of majority opinions that didn't have any lasting value for their ideas, rather than just representing what five justices happened to agree on in any particular day.
Carrie, do you want to add anything before we move on to our next caller?
Yeah, I think I love Greg's line. He helped people see what was possible. I'll just point out one area of law that didn't get mentioned in his almost exhaustive list, and that's Second Amendment law, because I think his concurrence in the Prince versus U.S. case, where he kind of threw out there, hey, we haven't looked at the Second Amendment in a while. Maybe we should look at it. Is it an individual right? Is it a group right for the militia? And then that really foreshadowed the Heller case, which was decided my term. So Justice Scalia, we've talked about after his passing, this was a crowning moment for him writing that opinion, but it couldn't have happened necessarily without Justice Thomas first, you know, reminding people, hey, we have this other amendment here, let's look at it. And there's so many times where he has done that. Again, almost always in a concurrence or a dissent, but those are that kind of is throwing out the mark for people to be aiming at for the next line of cases.
Well, we have four callers still on the line here, and we'll try to take as many of these questions as we can. So let's move right along to the next one.
Hey, this is Rich Wolf with USA Today, and thanks for doing this call. Sort of two questions. One is, he seems in the last couple of years, as he's had more and more dissents and concurrences, I guess, to have become even more prolific in terms of the quantity of his writing. And so many dissents. I'm wondering if you can comment on that and whether in the last few months that has anything to do with missing his good friend Scalia. And then, John, I think you had said you feel you're at halftime. There has been other speculation about the justice that, you know, as some of you have said, he has a life. He likes to get into his RV and move around. And I'm wondering whether you're all as confident as Professor Yu was that we're only at halftime or so of his career, as opposed to that he might actually be thinking about retirement himself.
Yeah, I think that's...
Let me just jump in. This is Boyden Gray. And say, I think he really loves being a judge, frankly. I mean, apart from all the other things, the contributions, the legacy, all that, I think he really enjoys his job, enjoys being on the D.C. Circuit, enjoys being on the Supreme Court. I don't see him going anywhere.
And I think actually he loves it more now than he did 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. One sometimes had the sense that he was doing things in past years out of his tremendous sense of duty and work ethic, but that his real heart was in, you know, the trips on the bus and watching football. I think his enthusiasm has only grown over time, and I can tell you, like at the clerk's lunches last term, when I think he is writing more, and he thought of those administrative law opinions as a coherent set. It's no accident they all came out together, because he was thinking about those issues proactively, and he was engaged, and he was enthusiastic about it. And he was talking about it with a level of just joy and engagement that is even greater than what I had seen 5 or 10 years ago.
I don't know where those rumors started about him, about Justice Thomas thinking about retiring, but I think those are just groundless rumors. I can't imagine why in the world he'd want to retire now. I think, you know, he always used to tell us, as you know, when we were clerking for him, that he wanted to be carried out of the court building with his boots on. I think he was someone who figured he was going to die in office, die on the bench. And I don't think anything in the last few years has changed his mind, as best I can tell. I would think it. I think he's a guy, the more he might lose some of these issues, the more determined it's going to make him to stay on the court, because I think he feels it's his job, his purpose in life, to continue to stand for these principles, even more so if they become unpopular or they get rejected by a temporary passive majority of the court. In terms of your beginning of your first question about whether he's writing more, I do get the feeling he's writing more, but I think it's more because he's switching grounds to a new front where he's used to write a lot more about methodology, about race. I think he's really discovered what I think is going to be the defining principle of his next decades on the court, which is his skepticism, questioning opposition to the growth of the administrative state. And so the way he works, it seems to me, is he likes to write these very broad opinions that really goes over the basic fundamental principles in the beginning. And so he's writing more now, I think, because that's the direction he's turning in. And then, as he starts to figure out, then it's more about applying those basic principles in his mind to each case. But right now he's going through, I think, the rethought of how to constrain the administrative state consistent with the Constitution, and that's going to cause him to write a lot more right now.
If you look at the stats, I think he definitely is writing more. It doesn't just feel like it. I mean, last term alone, I think Justice Kagan wrote only 11 decisions, and Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas wrote 37, more than any other justice. Partly because, unfortunately, there was a term in which he was on the losing side of a lot more cases, just because of it was a tough term for judges of a conservative bent. But I think he said something like, you know, we lost a lot this term, but we're going to make them bleed. And I think he really does love the idea of using that as an opportunity to clarify what these issues are, and then, you know, let the people look at it and really read the decisions. And I think he knows that for his own integrity, that's the real reward. And they're gonna. It's a little bit like what Justice Scalia's line about, if I had to sign under that opinion even to get the fifth vote, or I had to write that opinion to get the fifth vote, I'd put my head in the bag. He doesn't want to have to put his head in the bag. He knows that he's going to have to, you know, be accountable for what he writes. And if the rest of them want to write drivel or want to make up their own things, he's happy to be standing there and be the one who shows them, you know, the truth of the matter and being able to stand by that. I think that in many ways is his vindication, although I'm sure he would rather be in a court where they were all doing the right thing. I think he does still thrive in adversity, and I certainly can't imagine him stepping down, to even to do his American bus tour in a situation where President Obama or Hillary Clinton might be appointing his successor. That would be, that would truly be admitting defeat, and he's not the kind of guy to do that.
Well, we're already a minute or two over our allotted time here, but I'd like to try to take just one more question, if that's all right with all of our speakers.
Sure.
Works for me.
So this will be our last question of the day. I'm very sorry to those listeners who we won't get to their questions, but we'd welcome those by email. So let's go to our last caller.
So Will Courtney will be disappointed to learn that the last question, which he hoped to get out of the way quickly, went to Mario Loyola, myself, friend of John Yu and others on this call. Thank you for having me and for this great presentation. I have a question that we'll try to get through quickly, but it's a bit sort of historical. And it has to do with an impression that I have, I mean, after a long time of looking at these Supreme Court opinions of different justices, an impression that I have that there's like a generational gap between the Rehnquists and even the Scalias and people like Clarence Thomas in the following sense. I think Reagan, to the end, was a big fan of the New Deal and of FDR's New Deal. And I remember him describing himself as a big fan of that early in his career. And I think that for that generation, it seemed to me like the New Deal was always conceived as a great sort of saving moment that reaffirmed the faith in national institutions. And that helps explain for me the dedication to stare decisis that led the Rehnquist Court to basically reaffirm what I think Richard Epstein and I and others would consider the very worst decisions of the New Deal, from the Stewart Machine to Wicker versus Filburn and all of those, and the Commerce Clause and Spending Clause cases. And I think that, and I would love to hear the perspective of General Boyden Gray and others on the call, that something shifted with this sort of Clarence Thomas generation, which is a new generation of judges that don't necessarily have faith that national institutions have evolved in the right way, and that think that many of these decisions going back the better part of a century were terribly wrongly decided, and sort of despair at how we're going to undo the damage now. And because, of course, as John, you alluded to a moment ago, if you had five justices for agreeing with Thomas's concurrence in Lopez, it would repeal 95% of the federal government as we know it today. And so just if someone, maybe starting with C. Boyden Gray, could address that. I remember Scalia saying in the introduction to his book that sometimes wisdom comes late. How has that journey been for a generation that grew up, I think, very much believing in the strength and health of national institutions, to realizing that maybe something in the Supreme Court and in the larger body politic went really terribly wrong over the last 80 years?
Well, that's we could go on for the next hour about that, but I would put it on the simplest terms. I think it started with Scalia, I think, but Thomas was always there. As I said earlier, he has a great, I think, skepticism about big institutions, government or private, and the two tend to go together in the progressive vision of the 1920s. And I think he wants to undo all of this stuff of that you've heard throughout the theme throughout this call of judges, unelected, unaccountable, really, making things up. And let's just stick with the Constitution. And the people who did that knew what they were doing, knew how they wanted to limit government. The whole thing was constructed as a way of checks and balances and ambition against ambition to keep government within bounds. And that's what I think Thomas is really imbued with now. And I think that's what explains the decisions he wrote that have been discussed in more detail just earlier. I think that's what motivates him now, because this is so contrary to what the founders intended, and so contrary to what made this country so great.
Anyone else want to take a crack at that before we adjourn? Oh, it sounds like this might be the end of the call. Thank you to all four of our experts for taking the time today to share your thoughts here. This has been a really great program. We had a ton of interest from our audience. Thank you, everyone, for dialing in and for your great questions. But for today, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.